you know, with every lecture, as far as I'm concerned, things come together more and more, and the web that is being woven, and you'll see why I use that image of weaving a web, I think becomes more and more visible, and even more enjoyable, I think. Here we are at the beginning of the Odyssey, and I'm going to try to say all sorts of things that are about as central and core to everything we're studying as possible. The Odyssey is the sequel to the Iliad. And yet, all sorts of things have happened in between the Iliad and the Odyssey. And although Odyssey is a sequel, it still begins as if all over again. It begins using the same kind of rules of the game that we saw in the beginning of the Iliad, where the first word is the most important word in the whole composition. You can't tell from the English, but the first word in the original Greek is man. What was the first word in the Iliad? Anger. Good. And again, the muse, the goddess of total recall, is invoked. Notice how I said it, that if you look at it one way, the Iliad plus the Odyssey together are a seamless web. But that doesn't stop the Odyssey from pretending to start all over again. And I think that has a lot to say, may I say metaphorically, about the website that I have laboriously prepared for you, like Penelope preparing the fabric in the Odyssey. If you look at the first five verses of the Odyssey, the first five verses tell you everything you need to know about the Odyssey in micro-narrative. It's not only that it's about a man versus a sort of overriding supernatural concept, which is this larger-than-life anger of a hero, but it's a man who can't go in a straight line. And you're going to be asking yourself, well, how is Odysseus unseasonal as a hero? I think the easiest way to visualize it is what you see right here, where it says he traveled far and wide. In the original Greek, it's not just traveling, it's zigzagging. In other words, he can't go in a straight line. And that's going to be one of the basic ideas of the Odyssey, is that the hero, even though he's a great pilot, a great navigator, can't go from A to B. And he's always deflected from his purpose. And then you ask yourself, well, what is he famous for? Well, he's famous for destroying the city of Troy. That's what it says right here. But wait a minute, I thought that the Iliad is the epic about the destroying of the city of Troy. After all, didn't we see that the Iliad means the story of Troy? So then how come Odysseus seems to be getting the credit for destroying the city of Troy? Can I fast forward a little bit to one of the later close readings that we're about to do? So I'm going to fast forward just for a second. We're going to see later on that, in a sense, Odysseus could be taking credit for this object, this objective that is narrated in the Iliad, which is how to destroy the city of Troy. And we could even say, from the point of view of the Odyssey, that Achilles failed in what you would think would be the one material objective of the story of Troy, which is what the Iliad means, and that is destroying the city. We'll also see very, very soon that this has to do with what kind of qualities these two heroes have, Achilles versus Odysseus. So we're going to start already comparing in big ways and little ways the hero of the Odyssey versus the hero of the Iliad. And what made Odysseus succeed, and the fast forward has to do with focus passage E, and I'll get to it in a minute, where Odysseus succeeded is that he had brains, so to speak, where Achilles had brawn. And I'm not saying that the two heroes don't have the other quality in them as well, but Odysseus is predominantly a hero of the intellect, and Achilles is predominantly a hero of military warrior might. And it was the trickery of Odysseus that finally succeeded in the capture of Troy. And we all know that it was the Trojan horse, except we never saw the Trojan horse in our Iliad. And it'll be very interesting when we find out how we're going to see the Trojan horse in the Odyssey. So I'm still on the first two lines. Now, continuing with Focus Passage A, many cities did he visit, and many were the people with whose customs and thinking he was acquainted. In the original Greek, the thinking has to do not just with the people he is being exposed to, but his own thinking. And I want you to pay very close attention to this word that is translated by our text here as thinking, because it'll be the key word for the next lecture. The key word for today's lecture is coming up. It's in line 5 of our translation. Coincidentally, it happens to be verse 5 of the first 5 verses of the Odyssey. We haven't got there yet. But look at this word, thinking, noos, because it will be pertinent, very pertinent to the key word. And let's keep going. Many things he suffered at sea while trying to save his own life and to achieve the same homecoming, safe homecoming of his companions. So it looks as if we ask ourselves, what is the number one objective of Odysseus? It's to save his life. And how does he save his life? By achieving a homecoming. Can we look back at the Iliad? Remember how in Iliad Scroll 9, Achilles says, I just have one life to lose, and I treasure my life. And that word was psyche. Here we see it as the sort of prize for this hero. Do you remember in the slide lecture how the disembodied conveyor of Patroclus' identity after death was also referred to as a psyche? Remember we had that kind of schizoid view of psyche, that when you're alive, it's your breath of life, it's something you value more than anything else, if you value your life more than anything else. But when you're dead, it's an image, a disembodied image of your former self. And it's not really you. It's an image of you, which makes the loss of your life, when you're still alive and breathing, all the more painful. Right? So you see how all the agenda that we're already familiar with, because we have seen the heroic condition through the lens of Troy, are still here. And in fact, if I may give away the punchline of my whole lecture, the Odyssey revisits the story of Troy and helps us see it in a new way. And similarly with the lectures that I give you, each time we meet, we revisit earlier readings, and each time we revisit, we have a heightened, a richer understanding of the texture of the song culture we're studying, because this is the kind of thing you can't get the first time around. You have to keep coming back to it over and over again. And again, I come back to the metaphor of Penelope in the Odyssey unweaving his web, her web, every night, only to reweave it the next day. There's something very important about that image. And may I say that that importance is metaphorical, it's a matter of metaphor. So, the Odyssey seems to define the heroic quest to stay alive in terms of nostos. Nostos is the key to the preservation of Odysseus's psyche, which seems to be what he's striving for as he's going from one adventure to another, always being deflected, but nevertheless trying to go from A to B. And each time he does, the ultimate quest is to hold on to his psyche, and the way to do that is to have a nostos. So there's our key word, and I give it to you in the footnote. Return, homecoming, and then semicolon, which means we're now going to another register song about a homecoming. And then look at the definition after the second semicolon, return to light and life. Now that's something very, very metaphorical. And we'll start exploring it today. We'll have to keep on exploring it the next time we meet when I revisit. Get it? Revisit, return. This is all pre-planned. It's, how to put it, I've been doing this for 20 years in terms of the book that I wrote 20 years ago. Hint, hint, 20 years ago, isn't that interesting? Which is called Best of the Achaeans. I published it in 1979. Get this, I re-edited it in 1999, 20 years later, which is, of course, the Odyssean number for homecoming. When you look at the four columns, because your teacher has been weaving this web for so many years, the fourth column, or if you like, the fourth vertical thread in the loom, the fourth column is essentially my book, this thing which revisits 20 years later. And whenever you click on those green boxes, what do I have? I have a discussion that keys in directly to the main agenda, the main intellectual agenda of that particular lecture. Clever. I'm so proud of it. I can't tell you how much I love it. And wait till we get about 15 minutes from now where I'm going to reveal to you that essentially what I'm doing with that book and what I'm doing with this lecture is a kind of microcosm of my activity as a Homer scholar for 20 years. So that'll be interesting too, I hope. Anyway, it all comes back to Mosthos. And could I try to unpack the metaphorical language a little bit? I say return to light and life. I don't expect you to understand it immediately right away. We're going to have to do a lot more struggling with this. But can I say it maybe as a kind of headline, and then we can revisit the headline later and see if you like it, which is to say that returning is not just physical, it's mental. And when you deal with mentality, I'd like you to deal with two different kinds of consciousness. There's the consciousness of just being conscious, so that if you pass out and then you regain your consciousness, what do you say in English? You say, I came to. Well, I'm suggesting to you that that meaning, to come to, that mental meaning is here. But there's something bigger than that. It's one thing to pass out and then to come to. But what happens when you die? Can you come to when you die? See, for somebody like me who's a close reader, I spent once months of my life just looking at every death scene in Homeric poetry and every fainting scene. And you know, when you do this, you get hardwired about situations and you just know that when you pass out, Homerically speaking, your psyche leaves your body. Okay? When you die, again, your psyche leaves your body. But what amazed me is that when Homeric poetry say, I come to, you can't say the psyche comes back because there's something taboo about that. And that something taboo has to do with this other kind of mental recovery of consciousness where it's not just that you've lost your consciousness, you've fainted and you come to, it's where you've died. And can there be any situation where you can come to after you've died, after the psyche has left your body? Achilles says, and that's what he believes in Scroll 9, is no. That's why I value my life, I treasure it, okay? So you see how the agenda of the Odyssey are really a revisiting of the agenda of the Iliad? It's again this question of holding on to your life. As far as Odysseus is concerned, the key is Nosthos. And you see how, from everything I've said, we cannot understand Nosthos if we simply treat it as a story of a sailor who comes home. If we treat it as a case of a warrior at Troy who comes home to his wife and family, it's not that simple. There are going to be deeper meanings. And one of the deeper meanings will happen when we get to scroll 11, where, if I can put it crudely, this is just a metaphor, ladies and gentlemen, where Odysseus goes to hell and comes back. I shouldn't have said hell, because hell is a concept of permanence. Hades is a concept of transition. And that's another extremely important point that I can underline for you. But while we're on the subject of metaphor, I want to tell you that every time we come to metaphor, sure, I've given you a one-word definition, which is substitution, meaning by substitution. But I know better. I know that I can't teach metaphor, because Aristotle tells me that I can't teach metaphor. It's one of my favorite sayings by this great philosopher and this parrot of rational thinking, is he says, basically, in the Poetics, you can't teach people metaphor. They just have to learn it themselves. And not only that, they have to learn it themselves by example. That's why I really, really, really want you, I was already harping at you last time, to see this film, Il Postino, The Postman. And there's symbolism in the fact that he's a postman, because a postman is a communicator, is somebody who carries messages from one party to another party, from A to B. And in this film, there's a scene where the postman, who is very, very shy, wants to make contact with this Nobel Prize winning poet, Pablo Neruda. And he's already been reading his poetry, because he loves this woman called Beatrice. And Beatrice is not just a woman called Beatrice, it's also, let's say, an inspiring muse, because for Dante, for example, Beatrice, is the muse. So this man loves this woman and can't express his love for the woman, but he knows that women really get turned on by Neruda's poetry. So he figures, if he can get Neruda to teach him, the postman, how to communicate to Beatrice, to Beatrice, then he will be successful in expressing how he really feels about this woman, okay? And he will get inspiration, right? So in this scene, what we're going to see is he has just made his delivery of everyday mail, and the mail keeps coming from the female fans. And this is a decrepit old man, Neruda, but his poetry has such power. And so the postman, he's been internalizing the poet's words, and he's going to try to show the poet that he knows something, but he wants to apprentice himself to the poet. And so he's going to ask the poet to teach him how to do what poets do, okay? And the metaphor that I particularly want you to look for is one of the first metaphors that we were exposed to in our course, and that had to do with the metaphorical world of Heracles' own internal heroic psyche, his emotions, his thinking, and how that kept being translated into weather, whether it's clear skies or stormy clouds and thunder and lightning, etc., right? So there's going to be a very beautiful Neruda metaphor, which our postman has picked up and which he's going to try. Then he's going to try a metonym on Neruda as well. And the metonym is translated in a very klutzy way in the subtitles, because it has to do with a man who goes past the barber shop and he smells those familiar odors of the barber shop, and he starts sobbing uncontrollably. And why? And, you know, you almost laugh when you see the awkward translation. But in Neruda's poetry, that's like saying, this is a man thing to do, to go to a barber shop. And I'm reminded of some of the frustrations of being a man, of some of the things that cause heartbreak, that cause loneliness, and it all comes together in this one sort of visceral aroma of the smell of a barber shop. And then you'll see the postman asks the poet, is that a metaphor? And poet says, no, that's not quite a metaphor. Of course, that's a metonym, right? So look for that metaphor, look for that metonym, and Yancy will start, and then we'll stop in a very natural place right after this dialogue is over. Okay, so here we go.
It isn't true.
Adam?
Non ci ho dato una lancia.
No, immobile come la torre di riscatto.
Più quella di un gatto di porcellana.
Ho scritto altri libri oltre le ovvie elementari, libri molto mio. È indebole come sottoponi a queste similitudini in vita. Metta. Le metafore. Ma le metafore, come dire, e quando parlo di una cosa, parlo di un'altra.
Che è una cosa che si usa nella poesia.
Sì.
Per esempio?
Per esempio. Quando dici il cielo piange, che cosa vuol dire?
Che sta piovendo.
Ah sì, bravo. Questa è una metafora.
Ma vuole che sì. E beh, tutti capisci, ma questo non lo si complicava.
Gli uomini non hanno niente a che vedere con la semplicità o la complessità delle cose.
E scusate, sto parlando. Ah, no. Io stavo leggendo una cosa, no, stavo scritto. L'odore dei parrucchieri mi fa piangere e stendere. Oppure questa è una cosa che
non è data. No, no esattamente.
A me mi piace pure quando hai detto sono stanco di essere uomo. Perché è una cosa che pure a me non mi succede, però non lo sapevo dire. E quando l'ho letto mi è piaciuto molto. Ah, e poi perché l'odore di parrucchiere mi fa piangere?
Ma vedi, Mario, io non so dire quello che hai letto con parole diverse da quelle che ho usato. Quando la spieghi la poesia diventa banale. Meglio di ogni spiegazione. È l'esperienza diretta dell'emozione che può svelare la poesia a un animo predisposto a comprenderla.
Ok. I like the way the backdrop of nature is used precisely when the poet talks about nature. You see it in all its glory, in all its local glory. I love the Italian word piangere, which isn't really sob. It's to cry while you sing and sing while you cry. It's part of the song culture of lament, which, as we've seen, is not just about the death of people. It can also be about the unrequited love of people, for example. So I'm still on focus passage A. This is so rich, as I say, it's the whole Odyssey compressed in a few verses. Notice that next to the last line of focus passage A has the word nostos again, and this time we realize that Odysseus's nostos, homecoming, is on hold. Or maybe a better way to say it, it's still in progress. While it's in hold, his son, Telemachus, in the first four scrolls of the Odyssey, can't really do very much because his own identity will not start developing properly until the father has a safe homecoming. There has to be a synchronization of the homecoming of the father and the reaching of understanding as well as maturity by the son. But Athena, the goddess of intelligence, who is speaking here in focus passage B, is saying that she's going to get the process going. And so while Odysseus is on hold, where his nostos, his homecoming, and for that matter, his song about homecoming is on hold, Athena will start implanting, if I can use that expression, into the mind and heart of Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, how to start making contact with his ancestors. And you make contact with your ancestors, you achieve self understanding by way of going for the father, who is the most immediate ancestor. And so Athena is saying that she's going to help put that mentality into the heart of Telemachus to get the process going again, because the process is on hold. Let's examine C, which is an amazing scene of poetry looking at poetry. The Odyssey is full of this, and you see it especially in Scroll 1 and Scroll 8. Here in Scroll 1, Phineas, who is a court poet of Odysseus, is singing at a banquet, and the audience are a very unfit audience. They are the suitors. They are these depraved young aristocrats who are trying to marry Penelope, figuring that Odysseus must be dead and figuring that Odysseus will never succeed in his nuptials. So if you look at what's happening here in this micro-narrative, in this story within a story, Phineas is singing about the homecoming of the Achaeans. And if you looked at this in the original Greek, you'd see that even the way this is retold follows exactly the rules of how the Iliad begins and the Odyssey begins. So it's a very poetically self-conscious way for the poetry to refer to poetry. And the first word of Phineas in this performance is nostos. And nostos is a done deal. It's a complete story for everybody who fought at Troy, with one exception, and that's Odysseus, whose nostos is either still on hold or will be canceled. And Penelope, the wife of Odysseus, hears the song of the returns of the Achaeans. And what does she do? She immediately starts weeping, because for her, this song is not a chorus. It's not epic, as it is for the suitors, for whom this is an entertaining story of heroes in the Trojan War and how they made it back home. For Penelope, this is a reminder of her personal involvement with her husband. And as she says, line 2 from the bottom, I have grief, penthos, without ceasing. And that means that for Penelope, the nostos of the Achaeans is not an occasion for epic, it's an occasion for lament, as we've seen time and again with this word penthos, which signals the lament song traditions of women in this song culture. What's a kleros for people who are not personally involved in the story is a penthos for me, Penelope, because he's my husband, I'm personally involved with him, I went through life with him. And what you see here is a sort of difference in registers, that you can listen to an epic, and if you're not emotionally involved, it has sort of one level of meaning, but if you are emotionally involved, it has another level of meaning. In the sections, you're going to be exploring with your section leaders some very suggestive illustrations of this, especially involving Helen of Troy, since the Odyssey has so many fascinating flashbacks to the Helen of Troy story. It's curious. I wish I could give you more focused passages, but I can't. But Telemachus is still so clueless. The son of Odysseus and Penelope is so clueless that right after this, he tells his mother, let the singer sing. He's just singing epic entertainment, and people like to hear the most recent epic songs. And that's the poet's job, is just to sing. So you see, Telemachus is mentally connected, but emotionally he's not. He doesn't realize that technically there's still a nostos that is in progress, and he's part of it, Odysseus is part of it, the father and son are directly involved, but he doesn't know that he's involved because he doesn't have the emotions for it. Okay? And since we're talking about emotions, I wanted to show something to you that's very dear to my heart, and that is a video recording done in the early 30s. And this happened in the early 30s at a real time and a real place in the former Yugoslavia. The person who is singing, his name is less important. His name is Avdo, A-V-D-O. And he is singing in what linguists would call Serbo-Croatian, but what he called Bosnian. In other words, this is the Bosnian song culture. And he's singing about the heroic deeds of generations long ago, the glory days of sultans, courts, and famous court singers. He's just a person who occasionally sings in the coffee house. And a Harvard professor, who at that point was an assistant professor in the classics department, Milman Parry, who had managed to get a visa to the former Yugoslavia in the early 30s, actually recorded this particular singer many, many times. One of the singer's songs was so long that it's almost as long as the whole Odyssey. So this singer was able to perform in an oral tradition, the bottom line for which is that you perform while you compose and compose while you perform. And he could do it in long, long stretches, as I say, extending to rival the length of the Odyssey. Now, with the limitations of technology in the early 1930s, all I can show you is this one video-audio combination. And you'll see that the video and the audio aren't even completely synchronized. But it means a great deal to me because it's, so to speak, a compressed moment of the Harvard heritage in the study of oral traditions. You should be proud that you're in a university where this study was pioneered by Milman Parry, who started it all in the 1930s, then by his student Albert Lord, who at this point was a Harvard undergraduate who had apprenticed himself to Parry and who became in his own right a very distinguished professor at Harvard in the classics and comparative literature departments. He died only recently in 1991, and he happened to be my teacher, and I get this video from him. And in my capacity as curator of the Milman Parry collection, I take pride in showing this. And I take a special pride that we actually have this on our website. So after you see this today, where I've introduced it to you personally, I hope you revisit it and that it becomes more personal to you just as a Harvard student and as a citizen of Harvard. Okay? So let's run this. I don't know, I'm always filled with nostalgia as I see the sounds, I hear the sound breaking off first, then you still have lingering images, and then that's it. And this is an extinct medium now, just think. And it has been helped to be made extinct by the transfer of evil, so to speak, today. And people can do things in the name of heroism and heroic tradition. And in the end, the whole tradition can go up in flames. So first impressions are important. I have to show it to you this way first, from me. And I hope you revisit again and again. On the website, we will give you a discussion of the formal medium of Abdo, the 10-syllable line, how he can go verse after verse after verse like this. Imagine, for 12,000 plus verses, can you imagine? And what kind of hardwiring you must have, so to speak, in both your brain and your heart to be able to do that. And this tradition is now gone, and so I have a feeling, are you ready for this word, nostalgia. Nostalgia is nostos, and algia is pain, as in aspirin is analgesic. So there it is, first impression. What happened in the story of Troy? Troy was destroyed, a community was torched. And are we supposed to see that as something that's just, something that can be justified? In Focus Passage D, I think you start seeing that Homeric poetry can see things in both ways. Actually, we've already seen that humanistic ability to see things from the point of view of the other side, the enemy you love to hate. Here you see it in, shall we say, a more ethical framework where right after the destruction of Troy, look at B. Zeus saw fit, line 2, to vex the Argives on their homeward voyage, nostos. So this is not going to be a smooth sailing for the many Achaeans. And that's why there's so many adventures. For they had not all been either wise or just. One of the few times in Homeric poetry that poetry calls the shots and says whether something is right or wrong. What did the Achaeans do that was wrong at Troy? Not ready to answer that, because that's what the Odyssey will explore. All I want to say is, look at this. Athena is angry. But I thought Athena was on the side of the Achaeans. Wasn't she rooting for the Achaeans all throughout the Iliad? What has turned Athena against not just the Achaeans, but even in special parts of the Odyssey, though not all, even against Odysseus? I don't want to answer it yet. Instead, I come to E, which is my own nostos, if I can put it this way. In E, you see a 10-line micro-narrative taken from Odyssey Scroll 8. And it can be fairly described as a micro-Iliad. So you've read 15,000 verses of our Iliad. The Odyssey gives you 10 verses, and here they are. Can you imagine how much complexity there is in this kind of compression, where you can compress an entire Iliad, which is potentially 15,000 verses plus long, into 10 verses? Can you imagine how many agenda there are in these 10 verses? Well, all I'm saying is I wrote a whole book that's best of the Achaeans on the basis of these 10 verses. So that's why, you know, I'm shameless in asking you to do close reading, because I figure if I can do close reading of 10 verses for a whole book length, there's so much richness here that you've got to try it. You just got to try it, and you are trying it, and that's why I'm so happy that you handed in your papers. In this micro-Iliad, you have the muse. You have the muse getting the singer going. The singer, Deimobokos, has a significant name. It means he who is approved by the people. So in other words, this is an audience-approved poet. And he's singing about a story that back then, why does the narrative say back then and not now? Back then had a kleros that reached the wide heavens. And how it was about a quarrel and you say, oh yeah, I know the story. It's Achilles and Agamemnon quarreling. But you look again, the quarrel is between Achilles and Odysseus. This is not our Iliad. It's an Iliad, all right, but it's not our Iliad. This micro-narrative has variations that our macro-narrative doesn't seem to have on the surface. But believe me, our macro-narrative has the same themes. It's just that different variations highlight different things. And, okay, we still have Agamemnon if you flip the page. Okay, he's not one of the people who's directly involved in the quarrel, but he seems to have agenda. I submit to you that just as Agamemnon has hidden agenda here, look how it says Agamemnon was glad in his mind, he didn't say it. So also Odysseus has hidden agenda in the Iliad, in our Iliad. So it's just a trade-off of who is anti-Achilles in an implicit way. In the case of the micro-narrative, it's Agamemnon. In the case of the macro-narrative, it's Odysseus. And then we see again the involvement of Apollo, just as we saw in Scroll 1 of the Iliad. We see Delphi mentioned. Well, that's a twist, because Delphi is only mentioned twice in all of Homeric poetry, and this is one of the two. And then I like the sort of aura of doom. Here was the beginning of the evil that by the will of Zeus started rolling down towards both Danaans, in other words, Achaeans, and Trojans. Will of Zeus, don't you remember seeing that in Iliad Scroll 1, line 5, where the Iliad equated its own plot with the will of Zeus? We even have that here. And then the image of all the sufferings of heroes, as if they were a boulder that gets loose from high atop a mountain and then comes rolling down on the hapless victims below. All of that is right here in this beautiful revisiting, if I can put it that way, of the story of Troy. A revisiting with a twist, with certain things coming to the surface that were underneath the surface in the Iliad. And we're going to see that again and again as well. And I think the best way maybe to explore this is to meditate on a passage that you will be exploring with the teaching fellows in section. And that has to do with the third of the three performances of this blind singer, Demodocus, in Odyssey Scroll 3, is Odyssey Scroll 8. I took you through song number one. Song number two, we could spend three meetings on it. It's so rich with meaning, and I can hardly wait for you to read it. Song number three is what you're going to focus on with your section leader. And that will be perhaps one of the most interesting, both emotionally and morally, revisitings of the whole Trojan War agenda, where you can re-examine from scratch what the Trojan War was about, what the motivations of the heroes were. You can revisit the entire plot of the Iliad in terms of the Odyssey. So to wind up today's lecture, I would like to give you the punchline of why the Odyssey is the ideal way to understand the Iliad, as well as the ideal way for reading the Odyssey itself. It's a kind of auto-reader. Do you remember in the Iliad, you better remember, Scroll 9, line 413, when Achilles says, I have two choices, it's black and white. Either I have a safe homecoming, Mustos, or I have Achilles. But if I have Achilles, I have to die right away. If I have Achilles, I can postpone my death. Right? It's either or. What we're going to see starting from today is that Odysseus, just as he is more complex than Achilles in other ways, for example, who his divine antagonist is, and I won't get into that till next time, he's also complex in terms of choices he has to make. Unlike Achilles, who has to choose between Achilles and Nostos, where Achilles means a short life, Nostos means a long life, Odysseus not only doesn't have to choose, get this, he has to have both. He cannot have Kleos without Nostos, because he is the hero not of the Troy tale, he's the hero of the Nostos. And his is the last of all the Nostoi, his is still in progress, all the others are finished stories, his is the only unfinished story in Odyssey Scroll 8, the only unfinished story. And for him to finish his story, he has to have a Nostos. He has to be the star of his own Nostos, which will be the biggest Nostos of all Nostoi songs in Homeric tradition. This is it. And it's in progress, even as I speak. Why is there nostalgia? Nostalgia, painful feelings, piangere about Nostos. It's because, as the Odyssey says in verses 1 to 2, the person who should get the credit for destroying Troy is Odysseus, not Achilles. He's the one, through his brains, who succeeded where Achilles, through his brawn, failed. And yet, the story of Troy belongs to Achilles. He is the star of the Iliad. Odysseus is preempted, if I can say it, in terms of modern media. He has to make his own epic. He has to go beyond Troy, which means he not only has to rethink Troy, he has to go beyond it. And to go beyond it, he has to go back to who he is, which is a return to his home, a return away from Troy. And to return home, you have to return to yourself, and you have to understand who the self is. And that's what we were going to see from here on, Odysseus's journey of the soul, more broadly, the hero's journey of the soul, and rediscovery, revisiting of the self. Look forward to seeing you at the film Il Postino. Thank you.